This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. Happy New Year. I hope you had a wonderful, restful and joyful Christmas break. Welcome to the first episode of the Radio Times podcast in 2024. Joining me this week is the comedian Ed Gamble. He first ventured into comedy while studying at the University of Durham and quickly made a name for himself on the London comedy scene, juggling part-time jobs with late-night gigs. A regular on panel shows, Ed has also found success talking about food. He is a judge on the BBC's Great British Menu and host of the chart-topping food podcast, Off Menu, alongside James Acaster. In this episode, he talks about how losing 7 stone in his early 20s impacted how people treated him, and why, as a type 1 diabetic, he hates dieting brands using medication intended for diabetics to promote weight loss. Plus, we talk about the return of the traitors and unpick why everyone is obsessed with the show. Ed Gamble, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
Thanks for having me.
First and foremost, what is the view from your sofa? Talk me through your living room setup.
Well, living room setup, I've just been in there, but my memory is terrible. It's a two-person sofa and then various other places to sit down that my cat has commandeered over the years. So it's basically my cat's room and we're allowed to go in it and watch TV and play on the PS5. And that's about it. I guess that's all there is.
Do you have a big telly, small telly?
I guess it's a big telly, but all tellies are massive now, aren't they? I think it'd be harder to track down a small telly. It's, what size is it? 37 inches, something like that. It's big, but not like, you wouldn't go, why have you got that in this room? It works for the room.
It's not obnoxious.
No, exactly.
What have you enjoyed watching recently on telly?
Oh, well, I've had such little time recently that whenever I do get a day off, I tend to absolutely binge things. So I've just finished, there's a show on Amazon Prime called Deadlock, which is an Australian comedy murder mystery, but they've done both of them insanely well. Like, it feels sort of Scandi, but also it feels quite British murder mystery, but the characters are really funny and really well drawn, and the mystery is very tightly written. So that is a massive recommendation that I'm giving people. I think it's great.
And that's funny. That's passed me by completely. I've not even heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been popped on Amazon Prime. I know a few of the people who are in it because they're like Australian comics are in it. But I got recommended it like the other week by another comedian, and then I've just burned through it. I think it's great. And then also I just started Slow Horses on Apple as well, which I'm loving.
Yeah, that was another one that seemed to be kind of a word of mouth recommendation, despite having a huge cast. it was very much people saying, oh, this is really, really good. You have to watch it.
Yeah, because I think sometimes those things on like Apple tend to pass me by, because even if they've got big casts, because you just assume they've thrown so much money at this situation and I'm not sure how good the actual show is going to be. But it's fantastic, isn't it? It's so well written. Again, it's really funny and just the plot just really keeps you hooked, and the cast is incredible.
Do you have a comfort TV? Something that you return to again and again?
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm not saying this is good telly necessarily. It's called Old Enough. It's a Japanese show where they basically make very small kids do like adults' chores for the day and see if they can do them. So they've got like a mission to go on. They'll be like, have to go and buy some apples and then go and pick up dry cleaning and then get back to the house. And they've got all the cameramen are like secretly filming them. Like there'll be somebody who looks like a groundskeeper, but he's got a camera secretly like filming how these, and it is, they wouldn't be able to make it because it's harrowing. Sometimes they don't do it and they're absolutely devastated. And there is one where a little boy has to go down a hill and pick up some fish. And he's taking some fish down and then he has to pick up some apples and he just keeps dropping the apples down the hill. And it is, but it happens like three times in a row and it makes me cry laughing, but also it is, it's like the ultimate tragedy. It's devastating. But I love that show.
Did you ever watch that TV show that's unlocked a weird memory that was deep, deep in my brain? But did you ever watch that show? I think it was on Channel 4, and they had 12 children go and live in this pretend village and pretend to be in World War II.
Yeah,
in that era.
I think I vaguely remember that. I've definitely seen shows that are like the social experiments where they put kids in a house and they have to just live with each other, and then it just immediately turns feral and chaotic, and they all bully one of them, and it's really, it's dreadful when you actually see what's at the root of human nature.
And also you expect children to be so kind and so polite.
Yeah, they're not at all, they're awful.
So brutally honest with each other as well.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that is a TV turnoff? So things that, or genres that you think, that's definitely not for me?
No, I mean, I'll give anything a go. Probably when I was like a teenager, early 20s, I was probably quite snobby about TV and about comedy and about all of that stuff. And obviously, you know, that was around probably the advent of reality TV, and I was probably quite snobby about that at the time. But now I'm open to anything, and I'm absolutely open to these things that I previously would have thought were absolute trash and just enjoy them for what they are.
Yeah.
Mainly that happened in lockdown, so that was when my wife got me into Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and Below Deck and things like that, and we just binge watch those. And you know, it's obviously not good TV and it probably is the beginning of the downfall of humanity, but it's so much fun, you can't deny it.
Yeah. And also, especially during lockdown when the world felt so bleak, I think watching those shows that completely transported you into somewhere mindless was so essential.
Yeah, totally. I didn't like it when COVID started to filter into those shows.
I
don't want to watch a Real Housewives of Beverly Hills where they've all got masks on and they're social distancing. I'm like, no, just let them break the rules for our sake.
I've also felt that with content that is about COVID. Not that it doesn't have its place, but I almost think I've just lived through that. I don't know if I want to be watching a reminder of how we spent 3 years.
Well, exactly. And I remember, I don't know if you know the sitcom Superstore. They put a lot of them on Netflix, but I think ITV2 started showing them as well. It's really good. I think it's the same production company that made Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think. And it's like another like ensemble sitcom in the style of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, not 30 Rock necessarily, Parks and Rec really. And it was on NBC, I think. And it very, very like mainstream US sitcom, but very well written. And they had a whole series that was set in COVID and like the characters were wearing masks and stuff. And you're like, it's not what I watched this for.
I'm over it.
Yeah,
I want to turn a blind eye.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a fun comedy show. Come on, guys.
Yeah, come on. Let's make me giggle. Is comedy something of a busman's holiday?
No, not at all. Especially not sitcom and stuff, because I have written on sitcoms and I've been in a couple of sitcoms, but I still find watching good sitcoms like magic. Like I wouldn't sit down and watch a stand-up special. That is a busman's holiday because I can see the workings and I'm most of the time sat there going, oh, that's an interesting bit. Yeah, that's really funny. And I like how they've done that and how they've structured that. It's just not fun. But sitcoms still have a relative amount of room to impress me and bowl me over. And I don't know how people do do sort of massive narrative sitcoms or even sort of fun episodic things for a long time. So yeah, I still love watching sitcoms.
Out of you and your wife, who gets control of the remote?
It depends. We watch very few things together now because we just have such different schedules that if we're watching something together, then one of us will end up racing ahead. And I know that's supposed to be a big no-no, but it happens.
I'm with you.
I'd say we broadly, like, if we sat down together, we'll pick something we've watched before, or we'll watch a food show or something like that. So I don't think either one of us is really in control. I think we're good at agreeing with what goes on.
A democracy.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, and also I don't think either of us want to put on something that only one of us enjoys. But also she, and it will get on my nerves for the rest of the time, she will just be on her phone watching TV at the same time, which I just don't understand. But the thing is, she can do it and she does seemingly take in all the information. So I still, like, if we're watching something together that we're really trying to keep track of, I'll go, did you see what happened there? Because you're on your phone. And she'll tell me exactly what happened and can probably repeat the script back to me, but is also simultaneously looking at her emails and Instagram.
A talented multitasker.
Yeah. Really, really annoying.
If you had to have a snack and drink of choice whilst watching telly, what are you going for?
Interesting. If I'm in and I know there's not much happening the next day and I got a bit of time, I'll have a glass of red wine or two glasses of red wine, definitely. And just, I'm addicted to, like, salted peanuts and roasted salted nuts. I'll just, like, sit there just shoveling those in, which is, it feels very sort of Dickensian, but that's what I go for.
Makes you sound of a certain era, but why not?
Yeah.
You've got to like what you like.
I think they nailed snacks about sort of 200 years ago, so yeah.
What's your podcast of choice?
Ooh, at the moment, I mean, I listen to other comedians' podcasts a lot, and a lot of my friends' podcasts. But I'm listening, I hate to give the guy a plug, but I'm listening to the new James Acaster vehicle, Springleaf, which is a narrative sitcom podcast, which I'm really, really enjoying. Because it's just something a bit different as well. So I love all the comedians chatting to each other about stuff, but I'm enjoying the sort of the narrative aspect of listening to James's new one.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams, so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Okay, let's rewind the clock and take it back to your childhood. So you grew up in Southwest London. What's your first ever TV memory?
Rainbow's the most legendary kids' TV show of all time, and was my favourite show. And we had record it on tape so I could then watch them over and over again. I think it was set in a house. It was like a studio set. And there was a man called Jeffrey who lived there. But then the three sort of characters that lived there were Zippy, Bungle and George. You must have seen Zippy. Zippy's like an alien. He's sort of like a brown zip mouth alien. Bungle was a massive camp bear, and George was a pink hippo, also quite camp. I mean, they were all camp, basically. Kids TV in the 80s and 90s was just, everyone was just, it was great. It was just fantastic. They all sound like John Inman. And Zippy's very naughty, so I connected with Zippy on quite a strong level, I think, because he was just a naughty, charming alien. So I was a huge fan of that show.
I don't think I've ever met someone or had someone on the podcast who has such a clear memory.
Yeah. Well, I loved it. We went to see it live as well when I was a kid. I'm a huge, huge fan of Zippy, Bungle and George, the Rainbow Gang. There was also a musical trio who had come in called Rod, Jane and Freddie. And when I grew up, I found out that apparently there was a sort of love triangle thing going on between Rod, Jane and Freddie, which is quite exciting goss.
I do quite like it when you rewatch something as an adult, or, you know, if there are young children around and you watch a film that's intended for children and you suddenly realise all the subcontext.
Yeah. There was definitely a lot of that in Rainbow. There's actually a really famous clip that goes around, which people say is from an episode of Rainbow, where they're all the characters are doing, like, it's like really heavy innuendo. So it starts with Zippy peeling a banana and going, one skin, two skin, three skin. And before he gets to the next one, George comes in and interrupts him. But apparently they actually did that deliberately. It was for an outtakes competition at Thames Television for like the Christmas party. So that clip has got out. So it was like a big in-joke with the television company.
Funny. See, right beneath our noses. Was TV watching much of a family thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I remember I watched quite a lot of rubbish TV with my mum, because getting home from school, normally Ricky Lake was on. So we'd watch, like, you know, terrible US talk show sort of thing. And then all the soaps when I was living at home as well. So not all of them, actually, mainly Corrie and EastEnders. So there'd be nights where it was like two episodes of Corrie and an episode of EastEnders. But most nights of the week a soap was on. And I was very into those when I was at home and sort of completely fell out of the rhythm with that afterwards and have never got back into it. But yeah, a lot of the soaps, yeah.
I still remember the Christmas special of EastEnders, where was it Bradley got pushed off the top of the pub, and it was the most dramatic thing I've ever seen.
That might be post my watching, perhaps. I mean, I know loads of people get pushed off loads of stuff in EastEnders. I don't know why they build anything above two floors in that place, because it's just asking for trouble. But yeah, I love all the disaster episodes, all the Christmas episodes. So depressing. It's great.
So depressing. And you think how much, I don't know, misfortune can fall upon one tiny square.
Just move, you know, disaster.
Relocate. What were you like as a young person? I'm talking specifically about secondary school, Ed.
Well, big question. Was I naughty? Probably, but quite eager to please at the same time, which is a difficult contrast. Yeah, I mean, secondary school, Ed, I probably, you know, got up to no good. Started drinking probably when I was a teenager, and going out most Friday and Saturday nights just to sit in the Wimbledon Common and drink cans of lager with all my friends sort of thing. But no, I think broadly pleasant, but acting up most of the time.
Were you academic? I assume so. You went to Durham.
Yeah, well, I went to an academic school, and I don't think I was by far the most academic person there. I wasn't, as in the least academic person there. I was mid-table, probably, but I didn't try. I didn't really try. But I wouldn't consider myself academic, but I was given the opportunities to be so, I'd say.
Yes, okay. Were you funny while you were at school? Where does comedy kind of come into this?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I was funny, but also I was trying very hard to be funny. So sometimes that is a complete turn-off when it comes to humour, I think. And loved comedy and would go to stand-up nights when I was like 16 and watched stand-up, and I was obsessed with TV comedy. And yeah, so as soon as I got to uni, I was like, how can I do this more? And sort of investigated all my options at university.
And what were you like? Do you still remember your first performance?
Yeah, first gig was actually in Wimbledon. So there was a competition called So You Think You're Funny, and I signed up for that thinking, well, it's supposed to be for people just starting comedy. I since discovered that basically, you're supposed to have only done comedy for a year, but people do it after they've been going for like 3 years. So they make sure they're amazing so they can do well. Whereas my first gig was the heat and my second gig was the semi-final. So I sort of blew that opportunity. But it also made me do the gig, the fact I'd signed up for it and it was for a competition and my name was definitely down. So yeah, that was my first performance was in Wimbledon. I think I would have been 19, 18, 19.
Goodness, it's so young. But it kind of amazes me because I think to stand up in front of a crowd, it's different to, say, acting, where perhaps you can be behind a script, whereas comedy is so unique. It's reliant on so many things that, A, the people in the room will find your set funny, but also, I guess, the courage it takes, especially 18, 19. When you're at that age, I'm sure you're still plagued with all the kind of insecurities of teenage years.
No, I actually think it's why it's better to start young, because I actually think I had a bit of a bulletproof confidence and lack of self-awareness that if I tried to start now, you don't see many people trying to start in their late 30s. So I think the reason people start young is they're like, oh, let's just give it a go. And even though there are insecurities and there are worries about that sort of thing, I do think as well there is a sort of bomb-proof lack of self-awareness and like, oh, I'm funny, I can probably give this a go. People can pay for this. So yeah, and I think if I tried it now for the first time, it would be a total disaster.
When did you decide to try and make it a career? And how do you go about that?
Well, I don't think there's ever a decision. I think you just keep doing it. So I still feel like I've just kept doing it from that point. Like I don't, you know, there was definitely moments where, you know, I had other jobs and stuff where I decided I can probably quit this other job now because I seem to be making enough from comedy. But it's still the constant fear that everything's going to fall apart and you go back to working the jobs you were before. So it happens organically and it grows to the point where, oh, you're actually a professional comedian now. There's never an actual decision to be like, this is me now, I'm a comedian.
What were the jobs that you were doing?
Pretty small fry stuff. Like, I was lucky enough that my mum lives in London, so I could live with her and do jobs and still be able to gig as well. So I was working in pubs and I did a couple of jobs within the media sort of, but these really weird jobs where I'd have to get in at 6 a.m. and basically listen to radio shows and watch TV shows and write down what happened, and any company name that was mentioned, I'd have to write it down. It's called media intelligence. It's basically companies pay this company to log any mention of them in the media, so they've got any mention of them, so they have a sort of full portfolio of what people are saying about them.
How did your parents take your career choice? Were they supportive?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I was living with my mum. She certainly was. But I think both of them probably secretly worried. But I think that's the key, is if you are a parent and your kid wants to do something like this, it's probably just keeping an eye on them and not 24 hours a day going, I'm worried that this isn't right for you and that there's no future in this. But obviously, they were thinking that, because that's what I'd think if I had a kid and they said, I'm going to do comedy. I'd be like, well, you're going to waste years on that, and then you're going to eventually have to find something that makes you money. So they were supportive, but I'm sure they were worrying madly behind the scenes.
In terms of your style of comedy, I think it's often referred to as observational, and your jokes can often be aimed at yourself. And you've spoken about how as a child you used comedy as a form of, I'm going to say self-preservation, but I mean, if you made the jokes first, often people couldn't make them about you. Is it ever hurtful poking fun at yourself?
No, not at all, because I'm in control of it. And yeah, frankly, I can't, you know, it's just the easiest way for me to write. It's observational in a sense, but it's only observational from my life. And, you know, I'm never going, we all do this, don't we? I'm not that guy. I'm doing, well, I did this. And then you sort of hope that other people agree. Sort of a form of therapy, in that you're going, well, I've massively fucked something up. So you're just praying that other people have done the same thing. And you know, if you get a laugh of recognition, you know it's right and that it's fine. And then if you get a laugh of ridicule, you're like, well, it's still a laugh anyway, isn't it? It's fine. I'm just a weird guy.
One of your first TV appearances was on Russell Howard's Good News. What was it like entering the world of telly? And was it at that moment where you thought, OK, I've got this. This is going in the right direction?
Yeah, there's milestones along the way, and doing Russell Howard's Good News was definitely one of those. I mean, that show was amazing for that. They put on so many new comics and you got a chance to do like a 20-minute set. And I just think, yeah, there's sort of not been a show like that since where a genuinely like newer comic can do a set of that length, which is fantastic. So yeah, I don't think there was never like an active thought from me like, here we go, it's going great, because you just do these jobs and then there might not be anything like that for a couple of years. But in the interim, you're doing the actual job, which is live gigs. And I was doing podcasts at the time and just plugging away at everything, just trying to make things as varied as possible, which is something I've done throughout my career. I'd just rather have as many different things to sort of supplement the stand-up as possible, because then if people like you from that, they'll buy tickets to come and see you do stand-up, which has been the main aim.
So is stand-up the thing that if everything else were to fall, that would be the thing that you'd want to keep doing?
Definitely. I love it. I mean, you know, you've caught me on a good day with it, but I'm on tour next year. So like I'm doing a lot of gigs at the moment to get that show ready, and that's when I'm happiest, is just getting new jokes right and performing for people, because that's what I enjoyed to start with. So I love all the other stuff as well, of course. I love doing telly, I love doing podcasts, I like, you know, keeping it varied, but you know, the stand-up is the thing that I love the most.
What was it like seeing yourself on telly for the first time? Do you watch yourself back generally?
Never, absolutely not. I was there, so I don't need to watch it back. And also the only thing that watching it back will do is make me go, oh, that was rubbish, or I look bad, or it's like, it's never helpful, because it's been out, it's on, people have seen it. So, you know, it's the same with reading reviews. It never helps, even if it's a good review. It's pointless. You just got to get on with what you're doing. Nothing of that should change what you're doing. So you've just got to follow what you think, follow your nose.
Another thing that seems to be really important for a comedian's career is appearing on panel shows. What was that like when you first started doing those?
Yeah, good. I mean, I think it can be important for a comedian's career. I don't think they necessarily have to do it. I know plenty of brilliant comics who are having incredible careers without doing the panel show circuit. And the panel show circuit's sort of dying now anyway. There aren't many knocking around anymore. But the first time I did Mock the Week was a big thing, because I wasn't expecting to be booked for that at all. But they'd come to see me a couple of times and I did not know about that. And I just got booked for it. So it was an amazing moment, because I'd watched that show growing up. And then to have a really good first episode of that and get booked for a whole lot more was huge. And it was a terrifying show to do every time, even though I did it over 35 times or something. It was scary. But yeah, and they can be a huge driver of ticket sales on tour as well. So it's, it's good. They are important, but they're not the be-all and end-all, I'd say.
Why were you scared? Is it just because of how Mock the Week is seen?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's seen as a bit of a star maker. And I think you're just... Also, you're going on there for... It's a half an hour show, but it's a 3-hour record. And you're writing essentially like just sheets and sheets of brand new material. So every other TV show, if you're doing stand-up on TV, you will have drilled that set into the ground. You'll know it back to front and you know that it works. Mock the Week, you're throwing jokes that you've written about the news out there, yeah, and you've written them in the last couple of days to get ready for the show. And regularly, you throw a joke out there and nothing from the audience. Because it's not funny, but you don't know that because you've not had a chance to test it anywhere. So you basically, it's a whole new skill doing a show like that, where you've just got to learn if something doesn't work, it doesn't matter, move on, do the next one, without going, oh God, that doesn't work, letting your shoulders drop. So it's a whole different experience. It's a whole different skill in comedy.
Yeah, let's come on to talk about off menu. Can we talk about where your love of food stems from?
Well, I've always enjoyed my food, but I was like a proper binge eater and junk food lover for a long time, and still do indulge in those things now and again, of course. But then I sort of switched my lifestyle around a bit and, you know, started eating a bit more nutritiously when I was in my early 20s, and then really started getting into food and getting into like specifically well-made quality food and going to restaurants and stuff. That's when all that really kicked off. And I love food. I love talking about it. I love giving people restaurant recommendations. It's a proper passion of mine. And, you know, I've been very lucky with most of my passions that I've managed to be able to turn them into some sort of revenue stream.
Why did you decide to change your lifestyle? Where did that 360 come? I think, just speaking from like own experience, I think after uni, that was also when I got more into food. I think because I'd eaten so badly while I was at uni and drank to excess, as do most people in the UK, I think.
Yeah. There's definitely that. I was definitely, you know, particularly, I didn't really look after myself at uni, especially not in my first year. Second year was slightly better, and then third year was just chaos. I think there was a bit of that, and just being like, right, well, I've finished uni now, it's a bit of a fresh start, but it still took me a couple of years to get into that element of it. And just realising that I had some sense of willpower. I didn't used to think I had any willpower. I didn't think I was the sort of person who would exercise or the sort of person who would think about what they ate. And, you know, even doing it for a day, I was like, well, hang on, I probably could do this. And it's actually making me feel slightly nicer. So that definitely had a big impact on it.
When and how did you meet James?
On the circuit, just doing gigs with each other. I mean, even though there's a lot of comedians in the UK, the circuit feels relatively small. Like you will see the same people over and over again at gigs. And just also because you got that shared thing of both both being comedians, you know, you might run into someone you've not seen them for a year, but then you're just talking as if you see each other every day, really. So yeah, met James through doing gigs, and was always already very good friends with Nish Kumar from university, so I was seeing him at gigs a lot, and we're both quite annoying, so we both decided we were going to force James to be friends with us. So we would just bomb him with messages and stand really close to him at gigs and say we were best friends the whole time, because it would make us laugh, and eventually it worked.
How did he feel about that? Did he take that
He took it comically grumpily, I'd say. We set up a gig called Best Friends Club where me and Nish were friends with James and we'd all do the gig. And we thought that was really funny. And we maybe did five of them, and I think James turned up to two of them because he really didn't like the vibe of it. And he was very busy at the time as well. But yeah, that made me laugh that we set up Best Friends Club and only two of the best friends turned up to every gig.
Bless him. I mean, he seems to have taken that on the chin, but he's
just given up now. He's given up. He let it happen. So now he has to be friends with us.
Yeah. In terms of the podcast, obviously it's become huge. You know, everyone that I know listens to it. Anytime you say what podcast you listen to, they say Off Menu. Were you expecting it to be such a success?
No, I mean, the idea came from just the fact that we both like talking about food, and we spent a long time chatting about it. And I thought it'd be a good idea. James thought we'd do 10 episodes and then that would be done.
Wow.
I suspected it would probably run for a little bit longer than that. But I think it was the first one we actually recorded. It was the second one we released, but the first one we recorded was with Grace Dent. And obviously Grace is, you know, huge in the food world and an amazing food writer. And we did her episode, and afterwards she was like, you've actually really got something here. I don't think anyone's doing like fun food chat like this. So you might actually have something. I was like, oh, interesting. If Grace is saying that, there's probably something to it.
Mm.
And we just seemed to hit the rhythm with it quite quickly, and the format came straight away. And I just think it ended up being a really nice blend of genuine passion for food and also saying some really stupid stuff. Like it's the silly I say is on that podcast, and that really appeals to me. And I've found out that if it appeals to me when I'm doing it, it probably will appeal to some other people as well. So we're very, very grateful it's doing so well.
Well, it's one of those things, isn't it? I think it's such a good combination of, you know, it's a format that works, you know, and when you get, it's not that usual to find a format. It's like Desert Island Discs. It's just great. But it's also weirdly a way where people really open up. I think because it's not intended to be really prying, I think food naturally, talking about food helps people to talk about themselves.
Well, exactly. And I think that's really key as well, is we're not there to pry into people's lives. We genuinely just want to know about their food. But, you know, food is so close to a lot of people's hearts, and it's so important to people's, you know, private lives and family lives and all of that sort of stuff, and their work memories, that it does open them up in that way. But again, that's not a conscious thing that we're doing. We're not going, well, we don't seem to be prying, but we'll get some good exclusives. We've had people, like when we've had like bigger celebrities in, like their PR will be like, can you not ask them about this? They don't want to talk about this thing of their personal life, obviously, because, you know, that's the PR's job. And we always have to go, of course we won't ask them about that. We want to have a nice chat with them about food. Quite often we don't know about that. We got no clue.
I was going to say, it really makes me chuckle, because sometimes when I listen to the Paul Mescal episode, I wonder why, and it really made me giggle, because I think it was James who was saying, so you're here to kind of talk about After Sun. I mean, we haven't seen it. And,
yeah, yeah.
No, don't know what it's about.
we get a sheet of, if we're doing a PR one for, you know, someone's play or book or film or whatever it is, Benito puts a sheet in front of us before we start recording, and we'll go like, all right, and then start recording. And maybe 20 minutes into the interview, Ben will wave at us and point at the sheet and be like, you've got to talk about this. And the thing is, as soon as we go, oh, you've got a new thing coming out, you see their shoulders drop and they're like, I don't want to do this again. I've been doing this all day. So we just get that out of the way as quickly as possible and talk about food, because that's what we're
there for. Do you do much research beforehand, or is it no?
No, God, no.
Okay.
I think we're there to talk to them as people quite a lot of the time. So there's obviously like people that we are well aware of their work, because that's why we've said yes to them, because we're excited to have them in. But there will be people who we all have people who we're like, I want this person on the podcast, and the other two are like, I know nothing of this person. And then you have to go, well, trust me, they'll be good.
Yeah.
And the others won't do any research. We'll just be like, Because you just want to get to know them.
Because your schedules are mad. When you record a podcast, do you ever have to say no to some really big names because it just doesn't fit with your schedules?
All the time. The list is absolutely ridiculous. But then quite often what we found with really big names is we have a bit of a catchphrase on the off-menu WhatsApp, which is Benita will send us the name of someone saying, do you want this person on the podcast? And it'll be like, I don't know, like some mega Hollywood actor. And we go, yeah, obviously. And then he'll put, which will definitely happen. So that's like the sarcastic catchphrase, which will definitely happen. Because, you know, these stars, they're being like put forward for everything over a certain listenership and over a certain viewership. And the chances are when they actually come to do their schedule, they're not going to have time to do it. So it is funny, the names we've been offered, and quite often will not be able to do it as well. So there's many episodes, potential episodes of Off Menu in the wind that could have been amazing. But and we always think they'll come back round. If they really want to do it, they'll come back round. Yeah.
I spoke to Andy Oliver on the podcast before, and that woman is the most incredible person I've ever
had. She's the best. She's the best.
I'm obsessed with her. Fully and wholeheartedly obsessed with her. And she's so polite. And I've met her in person afterwards, and she came over and she said, hi Kellyanne, how are you doing? Is just comments on my Instagram posts, we're now pals.
Yeah.
But in the episode, we spoke a lot about, or she very kindly shared her story about how she used to have a problematic relationship with food, and now her career and her success is off the back of that reclaimed relationship with food. I know you've mentioned that there was a history with binge eating, and I wondered if you felt similarly that your relationship with food, although in the past has been somewhat problematic, has ultimately led to your biggest successes.
Definitely. And that's not by design. I mean, I just, you know, I like talking about things that I'm passionate about, and food's definitely one of them. And yeah, I'd say in terms of, I would never say that I had a problematic relationship with food necessarily. I was just very, very greedy boy, and still am a greedy boy. But now I've, you know, worked out how to enjoy food and not worry about food. And also know how food makes me feel. And my main aim in life is to feel good and to feel satiated and all of these things. And just bear in mind that food has to work with you rather than against you.
Yeah.
Which is a hugely important thing for me. And I think part of that is just enjoying what you like and not taking it so far that you feel rubbish afterwards. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that I ended up doing stuff within food, because I really love it, and I know how to deal with it now, and I know what role it plays in my life.
Mm. It's funny though, because I think as a culture, we are so obsessed with thinness and weight. And I think twofold, it's been really interesting, because I think often we neglect how that impacts men. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they're not as part of the narrative as they should be. But secondly, also how when we do lose weight, how that changes people's response to us.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this a lot in my book, actually, because when I did lose a large amount of weight, the amount of people saying, oh, you look great, or what have you done? You look amazing. And you're like, well, what are you all thinking about me before I did this? And you don't know what's gone on. And then also, you know, conversely, people saying, what's wrong? Are you ill? It's just like, I don't know where this thing has come from that people feel like they're allowed to comment on people's bodies and weight change, but it's really depressing if you're on the other end of it. And I do agree that quite often people think it's easier with men because they think we don't care about that, or that our weight is somehow just there for banter. And I think, you know, you can lay a lot of the blame for that culture back at men's doors, because the whole culture of, you know, banter and making fun of your friends and all of that sort of stuff has contributed massively towards that. But I don't think men talk about it very much. But yeah, I'd agree that people's reactions to the way people's bodies change is absolutely insane sometimes. And I say in the book, it's best to just shut up. Yeah, and realize it doesn't matter.
But it's also funny, because I think it also really plays into, or especially from my experience, like it kind of became a bit of a psyche thing in a way that it hadn't before. So I'd put on weight at university, I'd then lost a fair bit of it after university, and people were coming in with these comments. But then it meant when, obviously, as you become older and you gradually put on a tiny bit of weight, or it's easier to put on weight without realizing, I then thought it almost made it a thing for me, because I then became obsessed with, oh, well, now people have made that comment the other way.
Yeah.
Do they now think I'm much bigger? And it became a thing of self worth almost.
Yeah, it's when you worry that if other people have made that comment, you have it confirmed to yourself that other people are noticing your weight and they're thinking about it. So any changes in weight then make you think, well, what are they thinking about this? And it's not a path worth going down.
Mm.
Yeah, like I lost a lot of weight after university, like I say, and I didn't care. When I was bigger, I really didn't care about my weight. Which is so converse to a lot of people's thoughts about people who are overweight, in inverted commas, you know, that we were worrying about it all the time, but absolutely not. And then as soon as I lost weight and people went, oh my God, you've lost weight. And that's when I started to get worried about how I looked.
Yeah.
Totally. As soon as people started saying I looked nice, that's when I started to worry about it and putting weight on and stuff. So, yeah.
And I think in some ways for me, it actually propelled it even more. Like, I think I was quite happy with where I was at, which was, you know, a very normal size. I'm really tall as well. So yeah, I've always found it difficult because I'm 5'10". So if someone who's 5'4", or the average size of a woman is a 5'4", 5'5", if they're a small, that was never going to be me, and it never will, regardless of if I'm a healthy weight or not. But I suddenly became aware, you know, I'd hit quite a healthy weight, and then I thought, should I keep going with this? You know, if people are saying it looks so good, bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And I think culturally it's an odd thing as well, because, you know, as you said, culture's obsessed with thinness and people being slim, but also culture's obsessed with, look at the size of this burger, and let's all eat, you know, all the food that's thrown to us is the sort of stuff that's not necessarily nutritious. So there's such a imbalance there. And with the way men look, I mean, literally within my lifetime, the ideal body shape for a man has gone from skinny waif, noughties indie guy to now all I get shown on my Instagram algorithm is gigantic men. So it's all about putting on as much muscle and weight as possible and cramming yourself into a tiny t-shirt. So we're never going to win. So we've just got to do what feels good for us and try not to worry about what other people think.
Well, I think that's it, because it changes and it's so horrible to say, but bodies are fashionable you're never going to win, you know. Have you heard about that thing in America? My flatmate was telling me about it yesterday, that like loads of celebs are doing it, where they're using the drug, sorry, because I know you're diabetic, they're using that drug for diabetics.
Yeah, Ozempic,
to suppress appetite.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why the fashionable thing these days seems to be, let's all use things for diabetics to monitor our weight and our body health. But there's Ozempic, there's this Zoe thing as well, which drives me up the wall, because they're basically managing their blood sugar levels and going, oh, look, this food actually spikes my blood sugar level. It's like, well, yeah, I could have told you that. Just go and ask any nutritionist. Turns out if you eat a punnet of grapes, it's going to spike your blood sugar levels. But you don't need to worry about that because you've got a working pancreas. Like, so I just think this ultra focus on the scientific things your body are doing is just another way of putting people on edge the whole time about what they're eating and how they're living their lives. And it drives me a bit mad.
Well, they're hiding it behind wellness. Like, it's funny you say that because my boyfriend's a doctor.
Yeah.
And I said to him, we were on holiday and a woman had a circle thing on the back of her arm. Yeah. And I said to him, what's that for? And he said, oh, she's probably diabetic and it's to monitor her blood sugar. Then suddenly in the gym, I'm thinking, oh, there's so many more diabetic people than I realised. And then I realised it's one of these app things.
Yeah.
I thought, for goodness sake, come on, guys.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why. I mean, it's so stressful being type 1 diabetic. I don't know why people have decided to take some of that burden on themselves despite having a fully working pancreas, but I just think it's a bit mad. But there you go. I'm on a lifelong mission to bring that company down, so we'll see if it works.
I'm fully behind you. Let's come on quickly to talk about The Traitors Uncloaked.
Yes.
So when I said I was doing this interview, Hugh, who I work with, said, didn't Ed Gamble host a New Year's Eve party where he dressed up as a traitor?
I cannot claim to be the host of that. So it was a party at Josh Widdicombe's house, and the actual the creator, instigator and main person pushing everything along was Ivo Graham, who is also obsessed with the Traitors and is obsessed with games. So he basically said, oh, we're playing the Traitors at Josh's party. And I'd say only half the guests had seen the Traitors, and a quarter of those were on board with playing a game. There were people there with their kids. There were people trying to get kids to sleep. There were other people who just wanted to have a drink and a chat. And we were just sat on the floor in the middle of the sitting room playing Traitors. So it was Ivo, but I absolutely loved it and I won.
Did you? Yes. Is that why? So I thought maybe that's how you landed this gig.
Maybe that had something to do with it. But I'm also just, I was vocally a very big fan of the first series of The Traitors. Like, I was tweeting about it and stuff. And I have been a guest on Claudia's Radio 2 show a few times and talked to her a lot about The Traitors. I'm just a really big fan of it. And I think also because I do the Taskmaster podcast, which is about every episode of Taskmaster, I've got form for breaking down television shows to the nth degree and dissecting them. So I think they probably knew that I could handle this, but I'm very excited to be doing the job. I'm very, very excited.
Why do you think we're so obsessed with The Traitors? I've never seen people talk about telly like this. It was last New Year's Eve and everyone was talking about.
Yeah.
Have you seen it? Have you finished it?
I think it's astonishingly well made, first of all, but with quite a simple concept. I mean, everyone, it's social deduction, which is fantastic. And what I think is really lovely about the show as well is we know exactly who the traitors are, and there's nothing more fun than watching other people work something out when you know what they're... It's like Columbo. Every episode of Columbo, you know who the murderer is, but it's great fun watching how he gets there, and also just seeing people mess it up and people saying the wrong thing. And it's just, it's shot so moodily and intensely, and it's also at the heart of it, there's so many brilliant characters in the game, and that's what comes out across the course of the weeks that it's on. So I'm buzzed to meet the new lot. I'm very interested to see who they'll get, and also how the fact that we're in the second series of The Traitors will impact it.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there will be an impact on it, and I'm sure it will make the game different, but just as exciting. But I think we might see some more cutthroat stuff. And I speak as someone who has not seen a single episode of the next series yet.
Yeah, I was thinking this earlier. I was thinking, do you think people will be more strategic going into this series, having seen number one, maybe more of a game plan?
100%, because also there's international versions. I bet there's at least one person going in there who's seen every minute of The Traitors available across the globe and goes in there with a perfect game plan. But then does a game plan work? You never know. You've got all those other people potentially doing something different. So we'll see. I cannot wait.
See.
I mean, taking the job for me was 90% to do with the fact that I get all the episodes earlier than everyone else. So
I love it. Well, Ed, thank you so much for coming on the Radio Times podcast. This was really great.
Thanks, Kellyanne.
Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, do scroll back to our feed and listen to my conversation with Sarah Pascoe or Jack Whitehall. Please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.